Okay, so second try. I guess by now most have read the title. As I said already, MCTDHF stands for Multi-Configuration Time-Dependent Hartree Fock. I will explain in my talk what it means, and in some sense this talk is in between, so to say, the control community and the strong field community, in the sense that, I mean, we are doing control, and we are doing control in the framework of the MCTDHF, which has been mostly used, I would say, by now in the strong field community. So, and as I will show you, I mean, combining these two is really quite interesting, especially this provides a really interesting control problem, controlling the MCTDHF. Okay, so just a brief outline. First, I will just quite generally say something about quantum control, some goals, examples, techniques. I guess this is really, for most of you, old stuff. I mean, you know that, but anyway. Then, I will talk about the basic ideas of optimal control theory. Also, although optimal control theory has been mentioned a few times already, I mean, there has not been any real with all the formulas, and I also guess that for many of you this will be quite boring, but I mean, if anyone agrees, I mean, we can just skip this part. If not, I mean, it's just showing the basic equations. So after that, I will present the multi-configuration time-dependent Hartree Fock method, and then it's depicted here. And now with these two points, I will go over to discuss how we combine the optimal control theory with this method to control some few particle systems, and finally I will show some applications. I mean, yes. So let's start. I mean, I guess, I mean, I don't have to convince anyone here in the room about the importance of quantum control. I mean, David talked about the the control of chemical reactions. Then also, I mean, if one wants to make use of molecular devices for switches and so on, I mean, Hardy Gross talked about transport of such molecules between leads, but I mean, it's not only, I mean, it's the first step to understand the transport, but then ultimately one wants to control these systems, so one has to do quantum control. Then also another huge field is quantum computation, so I mean, I guess most of you have seen that. And, I mean, one wants to implement unitary transformation, that's nice, but I mean, somehow you have to implement these operations. And other examples for quantum control are, I don't know, for instance, state preparation, if you want to do some tests of quantum mechanics, quantum state tomography, and so on. So now if you look at all these examples, I mean, you see that quantum control is important really in a huge field of physics, I mean, starting from chemistry, solid-state physics, and everywhere, more or less. So you can imagine that since it's important for so many different systems, I mean, there are many different schemes or techniques how one wants to achieve quantum control, and one of them is the famous Bruhmer-Shapiro coherent control. So I guess, I mean, this was also already mentioned. For instance, just one example that nicely demonstrates the main idea. If you have this four-level system, you have a ground state, you want to control population in this state. Then if you have two pathways, you can either go via this or via that. Now you can also just go via both, and by controlling the phase, you can just have your constructive or destructive interference, and that's how you just control this. So that's really nice. And some other control schemes, for instance, stimulated adiabatic, Raman adiabatic passage, stirrup schemes, I guess most of you know this. So say if you want to transfer population from here to here, now you can do that very efficiently and robust. Then also, I mean, learning algorithms. And finally, optimal control, and that's what I want to talk about. Okay, so actually, optimal control theory is a quite old field. It started at the end of the 17th century by this problem of Bernoulli, where I guess most of you know that, and even most of you have solved it once in their life. So you have point A, point B, connected with some wire. You have a bead on which a gravitational force acts, and you just ask the question, how do you have to shape this wire that the bead goes in the fastest time from A to B? So now what makes this a control problem? Well, there are the three typical basic ingredients. So first of all, when we have an objective, that is in this case just the fastest way to go from A to B. We have a control, I mean we can shape this wire, that's what we want to use. And then, I mean, we have an equation of motion or a constraint, that is, I mean, the bead has to obey Newton's law. So now if we take this example to the quantum world, well, there's many examples for objectives. For instance, what I just mentioned, I mean, you can have just a population transfer. You have this quantum system in some state A. You want to transfer the population to state B at some final time capital T. So you want to just, the objective is to maximize this overlap. Then other examples, I mean, that was also discussed yesterday, for instance, optimization of harmonic generation, for instance, of ionization yields and so on, and I mean, some kind of paradigm example, the chemical reactions. Okay, controls, it's clear. I mean, the most well-known, so to say, are just our laser parameters. I mean, we have the amplitude, we have frequency, polarization, and we can just play with these. But, I mean, there are also other controls, for instance, in ion traps that you want to use for quantum computing. I mean, you can control the distance between the ions. And a more exotic example of a control, but we already heard about that also in this program, is just the coupling to an environment or measurements. And finally, I mean, equations of motions. Okay, in general, it's just the Schrödinger equation, but I mean, you can also formulate the whole thing in the framework of density functional theory, what we've heard a lot about, or in the scheme of approximative schemes, for instance, perturbation theory and so on. Okay, so now I want to focus on the problem of that we have just, I mean, we've seen this Hamiltonian also already several times. So we have interacting particles in the laser field. So our control is given here, that's the three laser polarizations. And we have a kinetic part, we have an external potential, we have a particle-particle interaction, and our dipole coupling to the laser field. And now we just want to, let's say we want to maximize the expectation value of some operator at some final time t. So this is our objective. So now what do we have to do? Well, if we do the optimal control theory, what we find is that we have to solve a set of coupled equations. So the first equation that we have to solve is just the time-dependent Schrödinger equation. Then we have some adjoint wave function or Lagrange multiplier, however you want to call it, that also satisfies a Schrödinger-like equation, but however not with an initial condition, but with a final condition. So this chi satisfies the condition that at time capital T, it's just the operator A acting on the wave function at time t. And our optimal control algorithm tells us, okay, we have to choose the optimal field according to this overlap with the dipole. In your case, just the dipole operator. So that's nice. And what is important is, since this fact that the adjoint wave function just satisfies the same equation, it's just the fact that the Schrödinger equation is a linear equation, and that will be important later. But what we see from this is that, I mean, in principle, what we have to do there is we have to solve the interacting Schrödinger equation, and not only once, because initially we do not know this condition. So what we do is we guess some field, we propagate this, then we have an approximation for that, then we propagate back, and so forth. So what you can see is, what you have to do is you have to solve the interacting Schrödinger equation, but not only once, but several times. And I mean, this was also discussed a lot in the last days. I mean, already solving this once is not very easy. Okay. K are the just the polarization x, y, z. And this dipole operator. Okay. Okay. So, and now the question is, how do we do that? And I mean, we've heard in the last days several methods how this can be done. And I want to add just another method to deal with the problem. Yes? With, so to say, that you do not fix the capital time T. Yes, there is. I've not worked with it, but I've seen papers about it. I mean, I can show you the papers. I think you. Okay, so yes. Yes, that's also how I understand. Yes. But why should T just run to infinity? I think there are examples where it does not do that. I mean, but the end of the pulse is not fixed. So the question is, so to say, I mean, let's say you fix that at, I don't know, 300, and then it might be difficult, or the pulse might look ugly to achieve the goal. And let's say now you do a calculation, but you allow that to be 400. And now you might see just a nice, simple pulse. So I guess, just to answer the question, yes, there are. Okay, now I want to talk about the multi-configuration time Pentard-Refock method. I guess at least the strong field part of the community knows this method from Armin Scrinzi, who's heavily using that. And I mean, the main idea I just want to illustrate here is thoughts taken from paper from him is just imagine we have this correlated wave function. Then usually what you do is you choose some basis, and then so to say these are the patches, and then you just cover it. And if the wave function moves, I mean, then so to say just the weights of these boxes changes, but the weights usually if you do a CI do not change. So you fix your basis. And the idea in the MCTDHF now is that when this correlated wave function moves around, that you do not only change the weight of the so to say basis function, but also you allow your basis function to change and to adapt to the solution. So how does that look in more detail? Well, the idea, as I said, is so to say to reduce the dimension of the wave function, and to do that you write your wave function just like in a usual expansion as a superposition of some Slater determinants, or just determinants, and the symmetry is hidden here in the coefficients. And now the crucial thing is that you allow both of them to be time dependent. And you do not fix the time dependence now by just plugging in this the state into the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, but you use the Dirac-Fenkel variation principle to determine the time evolution of this state psi. So what is important now in the context of if you want to combine this with control is that in general the wave function does not satisfy the Schrödinger equation. I mean that's just the fact. The nice thing is, so to say, you have this what I just mentioned, that the wave function adapts itself, but that means that it's a nonlinear scheme, and that destroys, so to say, that the psi satisfies the linear Schrödinger equation. Okay, so if you do not solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, what do you have to solve instead? Well, instead you have to solve these two coupled equations. So your coefficients. Yes? Okay. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is your wave function. I mean, it depends, as you will see, it depends, so to say, on the dimension of the expansion. Exactly. Okay. I mean, I will show that in the next slide. Exactly. Okay. Okay. I mean, this becomes clear from this slide now what you solve. I mean, you can write these equations in some different forms, so don't be surprised if you look in the literature and you do not find exactly these two forms. But I mean, they are in principle all equivalent. So what you have to solve is your coefficients. They obey a Schrödinger-like equation, and in some time-dependent basis, and these capital phis, these are just the determinants made out of these one-particle orbitals, and these one-particle orbitals obey this equation. So this is just the one-particle Hamiltonian of our system. This is a projector on the subspace that is spanned by all the orbitals in our expansion. This is the inverse density matrix, and this is, let's call it, mean field matrix. So what is important now is, and this will answer the question, so say this is the projector. Now it's clear if we enlarge, if we add more and more orbitals, so that finally we span the whole space, then this projector here becomes just the identity. And you see here it's the identity minus the identity, so this part becomes zero. And all that you have is you are left with the Schrödinger equation, so just written in a time-dependent basis, where the time dependence of the basis is just given by the, so to say, by the single particle Hamiltonian. Okay, but in general, I mean, this projector is not exactly the identity, so you do not solve the Schrödinger equation exactly, and a crucial thing now that is exactly, so to say, the nice thing is this self-adaptness that comes from this part. And so to say here, this is the inverse density matrix. It depends on the coefficients and these mean field objects, so to say, let's say like that, depend also on the orbitals and on the coefficients. Okay, so I mean this approach has several advantages. First of all, I mean, what I just explained is you get converged towards the exact result if you increase just the number of orbitals in your expansion. I mean, it's a first principle approach. There are no model parameters. It's non-perturbative. You can deal with strong field phenomena. And I mean, depending how you represent these single particle orbitals, I mean, you can equally well describe bound and continuum states. Okay, so. Yes. So to say, whenever you add one more orbital, I mean, you add one many more configurations, not only one. Yes, yes, yes. Yes. Okay. Okay, so now I want to talk about the combination of the optimal control and the MCT-DHF. And as I just discussed this, I mean, in general, our state in the MCT-DHF method does not obey the Schrödinger equation exactly. So in principle, we have the problem that what I described in the beginning, the control equations, I mean, you cannot use them. And in fact, I mean, what you really want to do in this case is the MCT-DHF method, in some senses, you choose a dimension of a subspace, and then the Dirac-Frankel variational principle gives you an argument how to choose that in the best way. So you always restrict your wave function to a, let's say, NO dimensional subspace. But it's clear now, this subspace depends on your laser field. So if you want to do optimal control with this, in general, what we want to do is you want to control a subspace. So it's not like that you want to keep your wave function, for instance, in a decoherent subspace or something like that, but you really want to control the moving in of a subspace and the wave function inside. So this is probably hard to digest if you think about it for the first time quantum mechanically. So I've put here a classical example is, imagine we just have a plane, and we have attached the ball to the plane, and now we have this magnet, this is metallic. Now you, by moving this magnet around, I mean, it's clear you can control, so to say, the subspace, the plane. But also, I mean, with moving around this magnet, I mean, you also change the ball on the plane. So the ball changes due to two things, so to say. First of all, because it directly sees the magnet, and then also because, so to say, the plane changes. So now you want to do, this is exactly, so to say, a classical example of the quantum mechanical case. So to say, your wave function is restricted to a subspace, and this subspace you can change with your laser, or with your controls. But your controls also change the dynamics in the subspace. Okay, and you can see, for instance, now, if you just change the subspace, I mean, not necessarily your wave function will change or the ball will move. So to say, if you tilt this plane just around the axis between the origin and the ball, I mean, then, so to say, you can change the subspace without changing the position of the ball. And you can also just change the ball. Okay, so you can imagine from this classical example that in general, I mean, this is quite an interesting but also tough control problem. So. Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly. And that makes it, so to say, interesting but also hard. Yes. Yes. So all along, so to say, your dynamics, so the subspace changes and you want to control that. Okay. I mean, in principle, you can change the dimension of your subspace during the. Yes. 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 Thank you. I mean, what you mean with the correct subspace, because you do not, in some sense, so you say you have the subspace is fixed initially. And now, and also the dimension of it is fixed. And now, I mean, you have a control, and that will change the subspace. But we'll just, so to say, I mean, like with the plane, so to say, you say, for instance, initially the plane is in the XY plane, and now you just move it around. No, we keep it fixed. But exactly that will be later the problem, so to say, if you reach a point, I mean, what is clear is, so to say, if you think in the classical example, as long as the constraining force of the plane on the ball vanishes, I mean, you can neglect about the control dependent subspace. Okay? I mean, so to say, then you could just regard the free motion of the ball. If the constraining force, so to say, from the ball on the plane is zero, then you have not to take it into account in your optimization. The problem only happens, so to say, if your ball, or in the quantum world, your wave function hits the boundary. So to say, if as long as you just have the subspace and your wave function, and the wave function just moves inside, but never hits the boundary of your subspace, so to say, then you are just fine with, so to say, neglecting the how the subspace changes. But I will show that later. I mean, this I mean, if you want to reach 100%, definitely. I mean, if you have, so to say, a highly entangled state, and you choose a, I don't know, low-dimensional subspace, I mean, you will never get, so to say, one. So this is... Yes? Yes, yes. I mean, this now depends on whether you, I mean, in this context, you see this subspace as an ugly necessity that you need to solve the problem. But you can also pose this question, so to say, really as a control problem. I mean, if you, for instance, have any measurement that somehow control dependent projects on a subspace, I mean, then you have to solve, then this is no longer an approximation for the time dependent Schrödinger equation, but you're dealing with a real quantum mechanical control problem. You see, and then you can still ask the question, I mean, what is the best way to, so for instance, I have a low dimensional state, and I want to have the best overlap with a highly entangled state. I mean, you can still ask the question, what would be the best in the subspace? So to say, it might be that there is, so to say, a time-dependent control that guides your low-dimensional state in a low-dimensional subspace to a low-dimensional final state. But I completely agree with you. But as I said, I mean, this doesn't kill the thing that this is still an interesting control problem, because you could think about situations where you really restrict your wave function via measurement to a control-dependent subspace, and then. I mean, you will see later that, I mean, you are completely right. It will be dangerous. And the nice thing is that it will show you already when, so to say, you are entering forbidden areas.
Can you possibly test yourself by describing special your configuration in this sense?
Sorry,
let's forget about time dependence and speed. Multi-configuration practical, is it good enough for two free states? Can you test yourself? If you show yourself the orbital is good enough to describe the interaction system by itself without field.
I mean, that depends on your initial state that you choose.
Yes, but at least it gives you some indication how good your set of states is. No? That's what complicated to avoid that.
Yes, I mean, you will later see that. You will later see all these things. Okay, I think we agree that, so to say, if you regard the whole thing as a tool to solve the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, then this is touchy. But I mean, you can think of situations where this is really a legitimate, so to say, quantum control problem. If you, for instance, as I said, just by measurement always project on a low-dimensional subspace, and you just want to, and this measurement is control-dependent. Okay. Yes. Yes. Yes, you had a donut, hadn't you? Okay, so, now we have this control problem. I mean, in principle, formally we know what we have to do. I mean, we can introduce some adjoint orbitals, some adjoint coefficients. We can define some control Hamiltonian, and we can derive control equations. I mean, here these functional derivatives, they can be solved analytically. They are a little bit tricky, but I mean, it's possible. And however, there are problems. First of all, I mean, these control equations are extremely involved. I mean, because this is a highly nonlinear set of equations. I mean, you remember there was this inverse density matrix and then this mean field, matrices, and I mean, it's really extremely nonlinear, so the control equations are really extremely involved. I mean, their numeric seems to be difficult. And interestingly, I mean, even if you increase the number of orbitals, so to say, that you really span in the end the whole space, I mean, the control equations that you derive from this set will not reduce to the linear control equations. Now I come back to exactly what you said, and this is, I guess, in basically what you suggested is, so to say, what I was talking about now is, so to say, we have the time-dependent Schrödinger equation, we do the MCT-VHF approximation, and then we do nonlinear control. Okay, but in some sense, I mean, if you really want to solve the time dependent Schrodinger equation, then we can also do first the control part. So we do the control, and as I shown in the beginning, I mean, what you recover are just Schrodinger-like equations. So if the MCTDHF works, so to say, for the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, it also will work for the control part. So you do, so to say, the whole control analytically exact, and then you solve the equations approximately using the MCTDHF, and not only, so to say, the state, but also, so to say, the adjoint state. And this is actually, this has also been done by Volker May and Wang and so on. This was in the context of the MCTDH method with nuclei. But it's clear that if you do this, I mean, now depending on so to say, how good that is, I mean, your control algorithms will not monotonically converge. Because in some sense, I mean, you are doing, this is inconsistent what you are doing. Because you assume that you solve the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, and starting from this, you do the control part, but then you solve it only approximately. And now in the following, let me just say, so if we follow this right way, I mean, then okay, then so to say, the linear control part, what I just said, is easy. I mean, the numerical implementation is straightforward, and this is, I mean, it does not require really much computational effort. Yes. Okay, yes. So, okay, but I mean, if we follow this, the way, so to say, that I've shown on the right, I mean, you have, first of all, what I said, I mean, you don't have, I mean, monotonic change of the objective is no longer guaranteed. I don't know, it may require large numbers of NO, and you cannot, I mean, get any results for whatever Hartree-Fock. And now exactly, I mean, what you said, I mean, the question is, so to say, you can discuss whether this is now really a disadvantage or not. But, okay. So, yes? Mm-hmm. Yes. 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 In some sense, you regard the MCTDHF method just as a mathematical tool, how to solve the Schrodinger equation approximately, or a Schrodinger type-like equation approximately. Yes.
But in reality, your joint function must be the result of actually your lower delta, which I'm the lower delta, into your wave function. That doesn't make any sense, right? Because your wave function, your joint, may be something non-overlapping, even though one of them has to be the result of applying an operator, and to be a local operator, to travel.
I mean, you definitely have a problem, so to say, if your with your first guess, so to say, your MCTDHF wave function has zero overlap with your target state. But I mean, that has nothing to do with the MCTDHF. I mean, this problem you always have. that you then stuck. But if they have an overlap, I mean, they can live in different spaces. As long as they are then coupled by a dipole operator, it's fine. And Yes. So I mean, you are completely right. I mean, as long as you are not converged, I mean, you cannot make any statements how well it works or not. I mean, the only thing that you know by doing that is if you increase your number of configurations large enough, then it will work at some point. But you don't know where the point is. And actually, I mean, to explore this now, I mean, we've looked at and to see how the pulses look like, I mean, we have investigated now two systems. So the first is for the strong field community, well known. I mean, the fruit fly, the one-dimensional helium atom. And what we did there is quite simple. I mean, we just wanted to excite the system from the ground state to the first excited state at some final time of 300 atomic units. So ground, that's the density, the probability density of two-dimensional plot, and this is the ground state, and this is our excited state. And this we can solve. We can do the exact optimization, and we can do the, so to say, the MCT-DHF. And so to say, so I first want to draw your attention to this picture. So this is now the objective, so the overlap of the final wave function with the with the first excited state for, this is now for two configurations. And NO equal infinity is always, so to say, the exact solution on the grid. And you can see the exact solution, I mean, it's really a simple optimization. I mean, you have a nice monotonic increase. But if you do it, the whole thing, if you solve it with the MCT-DHF wave function, so to say, with only now two orbitals, then what you see, I mean, you get an improvement, and then just, I mean, nothing. It does not work. Now, if you increase the wave, the number of orbitals to four, then, I mean, so to say, what you see in the large picture is this area zoomed in. So with four, I mean, you see already a nice monotonic increase, and it's more or less exactly the same. I mean, it's pretty close to the exact result, and just already six configuration will be just, I mean, on top of the exact results. So if you compare now, for instance, the pulse for the exact pulse and the NO equal 4 pulse, then you can see that, I mean, they are really extremely similar. I mean, even look, for instance, here, this shoulder is the same, and so on. And that's exactly what I told you. I mean, this really warns you, if you do control like this way, I mean, you are warned when you entering forbidden areas. Because, I mean, I cannot prove that, but I guess that's, so to say, the optimization is more critical than the, so to say, solving the Schrödinger equation. So this is real. In some sense, you can regard this as a extreme severe test for how accurate your MCT-DHF method works. Because if you do the whole thing with a just time dependent CI, I mean, this will always work. You do not learn anything about your convergence. But in this case, I mean, you learn that NO equals 2, I mean, is rubbish. wait. Okay. So, I mean, also if we look at the optimized state, I mean, that's the target state. I mean, it looks extremely similar. I mean, that works fine. And, I mean, if this is the power spectrum and the Fushimi plot of the pulse, and I mean, you can see, I mean, there are some higher order processes present, but in principle it's exactly what you said. I mean, it's just a pi pulse, and I mean, the main mechanism is just the resonant transition, and I mean, the optimization basically extends to a large extent to a optimization in a two-level system, and we know, I mean, the optimal solution is a pi pulse. And, I mean, we checked how well that works, and so, I mean, what we found for NO equal 4, I mean, we always just get with a pi pulse 92%. I mean, with the optimization, I mean, we get, I don't know, 94.5. And now, what was really at least shocking for me is, we took NO equal 2, entered the same pulse, and we got 6. So, although, I mean, if you look at the states, so this is, so to say, the first excited state with the NO equal 2 level of approximation, and this is with NO equal 4, I mean, they are pretty close, and also the energies are pretty close. So these states are extremely well reproduced, but still, I mean, your method does something completely wrong. And I guess that this is exactly connected to the state averaging, because in between, so to say, you have a superposition, and what you do in the pi pulse is that you coherently add up all these things. But now, with the MCTDHF at the level of 2, I mean, the nonlinearity is much too strong. You destroy the superposition principle, so to say, between these two states, and this really kills the mechanism of the pi pulse. Okay, I mean, it's just... And now, I mean, this is exactly now the point that you raised before. I mean, if you could do now the MCTDHF, so to say, at a lower level, and you would use the pulse, so to say, for the time-dependent Schrodinger equation, I mean, I'm pretty sure you could come up with a scheme that drives the system, but the question is really, what you mentioned is one has to be careful, I mean, how meaningful this would be. Okay, so now, I mean, this optimization was really, in some sense, extremely simple, because we just had this optimization two-level system, so we looked at a much more severe test case, and that was we looked at the transport in optical lattice. So, yes? Okay, we looked at the transport in optical lattices of cold atoms. So, I mean, for instance, I mean, in the quantum information community, there's, for instance, such an idea that you have an optical lattice and you have atoms sitting in the optical lattice, and then, I mean, that's your register. Then you have some marker atoms, and these you shuffle back and forth, and you entangle them, and so on. So, what we wanted to look is just, I don't know, to shuffle or to do something similar. skip this. So again, I mean, we just looked at two cold atoms, and I mean, how we modeled the whole thing is we had a Hamiltonian, again, kinetic energy. This is our optical lattice, and we just had a contact interaction of two rubidium atoms. I mean, that's the external potential, and I mean, these three parameters, that's our control. I mean, these are just the laser parameters of the laser that constitute the optical lattice. Okay, and now, what was our... I mean, initially, our optical lattice was in this double well structure. I mean, one atom was sitting here, one atom was sitting here. And now, by changing the laser parameters that form the optical lattice, I mean, you can switch from this configuration to a single well configuration. And it's clear, I mean, in the beginning, one atom here, one here, they are not interacting. But then you merge them. Now, both are sitting here, they start to collide. And the aim is then, in the end, to separate them again and create an entangled state. So, in more detail, so to say, initially we had one atom sitting in the left, the other in the right well, in its ground state. And then, by changing the optical... I mean, they're both in the... I mean, here's the initial state. I mean, this is the symmetrization operator, and... Okay, and the target state, I mean, that's not really what you want to do in real life, but what we did is we just wanted to create this entangled state. So we are only looking at external degrees of motion, and we just, so to say, wanted to entangle the external degrees of motion of the two atoms. So we wanted to reach this Bell state. Okay, here again, some density plots of the probability density. And now, I mean, this is a really severe test for the MCTDHF method, because, I mean, in this case, the particle-particle interaction is really crucial. Because without particle-particle interaction, I mean, you cannot create entanglement. But if you look at the MCTDHF method equations, you also see that in principle, the only thing that is approximated is the contribution of the particle-particle interaction. The single particle Hamiltonian, the contribution of the single particle Hamiltonian to the time evolution is treated exactly. So this is now a process that really that depends on exactly this part of the Hamiltonian that we truncate. Okay, so we did the optimization. So this is the result. So the black curve is now, this is without particle-particle interaction. And as you can see, I mean, you cannot reach 1, but it stops at 0.5. So this is the best that you can reach. And if you look at without interaction, I mean, what is the state is that you just create a coherent superposition of ground and first excited state in each well. I mean, that's the best that you can do. Because, I mean, this is just the overlap of our final, so to say, state with the entangled state. And you can see, I mean, without interaction, if you look at this, without interaction, this part, this is zero. So the number of initial configurations that you have, I mean, is fixed. And now if you see, I mean, in the initial wave function, so to say, you have just one configuration, but later you need two. So without particle-particle interaction, I mean, so to say, you see the particle-particle interaction, I mean, that creates the coefficient. So if that's not here, I mean, you can just get 1.5 if you overlap these two states. Okay, now if we switch on the particle-particle interaction, the red curve, I can immediately go to this one. The red curve now is again the exact result. I mean, what you can see, first of all, I mean, the optimization is much, much more slower than with the helium. I mean, optimizing this process is much harder. I mean, you see, I mean, only after more than 50 iterations, I mean, we've just reached, I don't know, 75%, something like that. And if you can see again, I mean, with the red curve, you can see a nice monotonic increase, but with and O equal 4, I mean, there you see these bumps where, so to say, if you think about this subspace picture, where, so to say, the boundary of your subspace is important, that influences dynamics in that way that the optimization is no longer monotonic. But what is nice is, I mean, you can see, I mean, it always tracks back the exact solution. And if you look at the final state here, that's plotted here, then you can see, I mean, so to say, the part of the state that ends up, so to say, with one particle in the right and in the left well, I mean, that's quite well reproduced. I mean, the main problem here is still that you cannot separate the particles again, that you end up with finding two particles in one well. But actually, I mean, purifying such a state should, I guess, not be too difficult. Okay, and yes? I mean, you control the optical lattice, so to say, the lattice potential. I mean, this is, so to say, the external potential on the atom, and there you have these three parameters. I mean, that's the angle between the lasers and so on. I mean, we've chosen there something like 0.15 microseconds, milliseconds, for the whole process. I have to check. I don't know at the moment. Okay. So in these cases where we looked at, I mean, this combination really worked quite well for only, so to say, low number of configurations. And I mean, what is especially nice is that my guess is that the number of configurations should not depend that much on whether you do this in 3D or 1D. So I think that you should be able to treat these problems also nicely. I mean, it becomes much more difficult. But in principle, if your subspace is large enough, I mean, they should give the same results both optimization schemes. Although, so to say, the way to the objective might be different. Because as I said, the control equations, so to say, they are equal at the stationary point, but I mean, during the process. Yes? And you also have to, this also depends a lot on the target or what you want to optimize. I mean, as long as you want to optimize a state-to-state transition, then you are exactly at the resonant case and so on. This is quite touchy. For instance, if you imagine that you just want to move the density around, I mean, then it should be... Yes. I mean, the problem is for a fixed, so to say, dimension, this one does not really work. I mean, this is, so to say, inconsistent, so it's mathematically not really well. Why? With the problems of the delta function, yes, certainly. Okay, so we are pretty far. So, sorry, I forgot the question. Okay, yes. Okay, so I think I will just skip the summary. You can read it if you want. And okay. So, thank you.